I'm pleased now to introduce our next speaker, Mike Fordham. And he is going to talk to you about a year in judicial review. Now, Mike, as we all know, is author of the Public Lawyer's Bible, the Judicial Review Handbook. And we're all, I'm sure, waiting with bated breath to hear what he has to say to us about the leading cases of the year in judicial review. Mike.
Thanks. Well, first of all, so much for Wikipedia. And secondly, congratulations to whoever it was who said, let's have a tape running when people address this seminar. I hope they had pressed record half an hour ago. Tonight is the annual Public Law Project Ball, sponsored by Herbert Smith, as you know, and you're all invited. Everybody will be there. Sir Alan will have finished his judgment and will be back. You know what you're going to wear. The whole public law world will be there. And being public lawyers, they will all be talking all night about the law and developments in the law. Nightmare. You're not sure you are paying attention, and you don't want to be exposed when you're talking to the judiciary and are not able to pinpoint their latest and most brilliant judgment in judicial review. Fear not, help is at hand. In your file is a very short paper with some very short summaries of some cases from the last 12 months. And I guarantee those are the only ones you need to know. Nothing else is important. And I guarantee that that's all you need to know about them. You don't need to read them. You don't even need to read the headnote. You can read it on the tube, or just read it during coffee if you're staying for the annual PLP ball tonight. And you can look at it now if you're bored. In fact, look at it now anyway. And the usual rules apply. Have a look through the cases and put a tick in the margin if it's a case that you are familiar with. And that shouldn't be disappointing. I'm learning nothing new. That should be affirming. I knew that one. If it's your case, it's like a double word score. Put another tick and you get an extra point. And while I speak about my four topics, which are going to be practice and procedure, the availability of judicial review, natural justice and proportionality, I'm just going to take some of the cases and say something about them, having guaranteed that you don't actually need to know any more about them. While I do that, do your score and see where you get to by the end. So, practice and procedure. There used to be a rule called O'Reilly and Mackman, and then there was a decade of cases saying we didn't really mean it. O'Reilly and Mackman was the case that said if you don't go by judicial review and it's a public law case, then you'll be thrown out of court because you should go by judicial review. And then they said, no, not really. Got to be flexible, doesn't really matter if you're defending proceedings, that's okay if it's a mixed case. Or anyway, we don't really want to get hung up on procedural disputes, and that really is a waste of money. So that's where we were. But TRIM, and this is all in date order, so there's no difficulty locating things on the map. TRIM, tick if you knew it, double tick if you were in it. 20th of December of last year, it's the top of page 3, a decision of the Court of Appeal tells us that that's O'Reilly and Mackman, that rule is still a good rule of judicial review, of practice and procedure. You can throw a case out, as the Court of Appeal did, on the basis that it was a purely public act, and purely public acts should be challenged by judicial review. So when the breach of condition notice was served on Dorset, on a Dorset farmhouse, that should never have been built because it was in breach of planning control. You couldn't wait 18 months to bring a claim form action saying that it was unlawful. Here we go again, if that's right, because that's what the way the principle was stated before we had the decade retreating from it. I'll just tell you what the true principle is. The true principle is not if you have a purely public act, you have to go by judicial review. The true principle is that you cannot get round the delay rules in judicial review by bringing a late claim form action. If he'd gone by claim form promptly at the time, he would have been fine. I promise you, he would have been fine. So it's an abuse of process principle that just reinforces the fact that you can't delay. Of course, what you can do is wait and be sued and raise your public law point then. And the latest examples of that in the human rights context, you know, all those possession cases about whether you can raise Article 8 as a defence. The two that you need to locate on this map are firstly Pinnock, which is the 3rd of November in 2010, middle of page 2, and then the most recent one is Powell, which is towards the bottom of page 3 in February of this year, both in the Supreme Court. And of course it was a lie. You do have to read them. You do have to read all the judgments. And when you've spent 2 hours reading all the judgments, good luck. Give me a call and tell me in crisp terms what it is that you think that they have decided. Uniplex. Hope that rings a bell. Uniplex has been a bit of a revolution because that's the case in the ECJ in Luxembourg that says promptness can't be relied on if you've got an EU-based challenge. So if providing they're within 3 months, good enough. It was a public procurement case. Because promptness is too uncertain to meet the standards of legal prescription prescribed by law. It's too uncertain, so we can put it to one side. That's a very striking and corrosive and important decision. And so we've had now loads of cases, and they're still going on, about what that really means. Just note, tick in the margin because you knew it, Bug Life, March of this year. You and Partners is July of this year. And the most recent one is McRae, which is September of this year. And what the courts are saying at the moment is, yes, that really does mean what it says. It's not just procurement. If you've got an EU case, they don't have to be prompt. They can wait till the very end of a three-month period. But it doesn't mean that the promptness requirement is too uncertain in non-EU cases. And that's where we are as at today. BP. I've nearly finished practice and procedure. I know it's not riveting, but it is important. Paper disposal of a judicial review. 17th of March of this year, Court of Appeal. What had happened was there were judicial review cases had been brought, permission had been granted. Then there was a development which was thought to make them academic. The government said, we don't really want to have to bother with these cases. And so said to the court, could you just please dismiss these? Because they've been rendered academic by recent events. And that's what the courts did. They said, we will list this for disposal, which meant someone was going to just nod in court and say these cases are dismissed because they're not academic. And the cases were taken to the Court of Appeal, who said in emphatic terms, you cannot do that in judicial review. Once you've got permission, you cannot apply to set it aside, because there's a rule that says so. It's rule 54.13. And you have to have an oral hearing, unless the parties agree that you can dispose of the matter on the papers. And there's a good rule that ought to save costs in appropriate cases. I'm not aware of anyone ever using it. Have you ever used CPR 54.18 and agreed with the other side that we do want this case substantively disposed of, but we don't want to have all the costs of having to turn up and have an argument? Let's just go and get a free opinion from a judge. You write your arguments, we'll write arguments, our arguments, we'll all agree this is a case for 54.18, and the judge is going to have to find a day to read it, think about it, and give a ruling. Brilliant. Hands up, who's ever used CPR 5418 to get a judgment from a court in a judicial review without having to have a hearing. I'm not shocked. I've never heard of an example. They relied on it in this case, in BP. They said that's the only way you can do it. And unless the parties agree, there's no other way. It doesn't matter what the issue is. It doesn't matter whether you think you've got a quick kill. Finally, in relation to practice and procedure, costs, very important. The crack litigation team of the PLP were there. The case is Barter. It's the 26th of July of this year in the Court of Appeal. And they revisited that case of Boxall, the one that deals with how you allocate costs when the case goes away because the defendant gives in, effectively, or they give you what you wanted. So there's nothing left to fight about. And what they said was, where the case has been conceded, particularly after a clear letter before claim, the defendant cannot any longer get away with saying, oh, well, only a judge who is satisfied that it's clear and obvious that the claimant would have won, only then will you get your costs. You can't get away with saying something I once said for the ITC. Well, this was a pragmatic decision. You can't read into it the fact that they thought they were going to lose. They're entitled to look at it again. Public authorities do that. It's very responsible. Don't penalise them from looking at it again. You can't do that. You can't say we're a public authority, we're strapped for cash. You cannot use James Edie's golden line that he is instructed to use for the government in every single case. He has to use the phrase, and watch out for it when you're in court, these straitened times. You're not allowed to do a case for government, whatever it is, without saying these straitened times. Well, none of that's going to do in relation to costs. Sadly, in Barter, even the crack litigation team of the PLP could not get the Court of Appeal to say what the principles actually are. No, we're not going to do that. It would be unduly prescriptive. You've got to look at all the facts and circumstances of the particular case. Well, thanks, I think, but we might have done slightly better than that. That's practice and procedure, and that's it. You don't need to worry about anything else. Availability of judicial review. Just know, and particularly if you have anything to do with the Institute of Legal Executives, I noticed from the form that you're allowed to sign in for ILEX points. I don't know if anyone signed in for ILEX points, but ILEX, the Institute of Legal Executives, the case is Cower, 23rd of November of last year, is amenable to judicial review. So that's handy to know, just in case something goes wrong. They're an approved regulator. That makes them a public authority. It doesn't matter that they're a private company. They are discharging a public function. No great surprise. Woolworths, 3rd of December of last year, was the Parliamentary Election Court. They're amenable to judicial review. And then we had CART. And CART was the case under the brave new world of the tribunal system, where the upper tribunal is finally disposing of cases, including by refusing leave to appeal. What are we going to do about that? We don't really want all those cases coming to the high courts, is what they're saying. Because it rather undermines having a tribunal system. On the other hand, that's not very good for access to justice, is it? And making sure that errors of law are being corrected. So there was a bit of a fudge. Yes, rule of law, wave the banner. You can't exclude judicial review, even though you've said it's a superior court of record, even though it's obvious that the intention was to exclude judicial review. There has to be judicial review, obviously, but only a bit. And only a bit. So turn back the clock to Annie's Minnick. You're going to need a very old De Smith and have a look. And whatever the law was before Annie's Minnick, that's the bit that you can have of judicial review. That's what the court said. Divisional court said that sounded good to them. Court of Appeal said that sounded good to them. The Supreme Court said, no, come on, you've got to be joking. You can't go back to all that stuff. We couldn't work it at the time. We can't even remember it. No one's going to have a clue. So it can't be that. So what we'll have is we'll have judicial review. It's a very important rule of law, accountability. Can't exclude judicial review. But we will only have it a bit, and the bit that we will have is we'll pretend this is a second appeal, so it's second tier appeals test, and so it's got to be something really important, not to you, not to your client, but important to everybody, or enough people, or us. And that's now the rule, so good luck with that. It's a bit like the feedback form, that's a bit terrifying actually, that I've never seen this before. You'll need to fill this in. It's very important. It says, how informative was the speaker, etc. What worries me is sort of. Have you seen that? Sort of. I've never seen that before. useful did you find the printed materials? You were in the taxi going to the PLP ball, having a quick look, so you're not going to be exposed. Sort of. I don't know whether that means you couldn't make your minds up, or whether it means you're indifferent. Whatever you tick, please don't tick sort of. I don't care, not really is fine, but sort of. Anyway, we got sort of from the Supreme Court in court. And they do it, so, you know, it's not the only time they've done it. In Lumber, the other crack litigation team PLP case about the unlawful detention because they had a secret policy. They had a policy. This is great. If you don't know this story, you should read it. Published policy, we don't detain asylum seekers or immigration claimants unless there is a really good reason. We have a presumption against it. It's not a good thing. So that wave the banner. Undisclosed policy, just a word in your ear, actually written down, never disclosed, except to those making the decisions. We'd like you to detain them all. Please. That's not joking. And that's what happened. And so then it finally comes out, eventually, after lots of cases where this is not disclosed even to the court. If you're looking for something to have an inquiry into, that wouldn't be a bad one. Anyway, finally comes out, then they say, this is shocking, terrible. Of course, it's unlawful to detain incompatibly with your published policy. It's ironic. We've never had proper standards in relation to immigration detention ever. And now, finally, the rule of law finds government policy as a basis for holding government to account. But that's what they did. If you don't detain compatibly with your published policy, that is unlawful. It's not purely policy, it's law. It's a source of law, the legal prescription, the rules. And that's what people are entitled to rely on. So it's unlawful. And then the government says, but even under that policy, there would have been good reasons to detain these people. We would have detained these people. So it's not unlawful detention, is it? And then the court says, Well, rule of law, wave the banner. So, no, it is unlawful, actually, even though you would definitely have detained them. But no, don't give them any damages. No damages. So, nominal, £1. Which is, I'm afraid, as Lord Brown spotted on the day in his judgment, I mean, that doesn't really work. Come on, if you're going to say it is unlawful detention, then what has to follow, strict or false imprisonment, is damages. If you're not prepared to say that, what's that reveal about what you're saying about accountability? What's the government going to do anyway? Well, this would be unlawful, but there wouldn't be any damages. So shall we or shan't we? And you go, your application for habeas corpus or judicial review, I want my client released. What's going to happen now? Well, we've had another look. We had a look yesterday. Here's a new decision, and we've decided to detain them anyway. So, sort of. Evans, 12th of May of this year in the Divisional Court. Brilliant. It was what Lord Justice Moses was just talking about on tape. The telling theme, the easy target. This was the Lord Chancellor amending the Legal Aid Funding Code to get rid of public interest challenges unless they were of direct benefit to the claimant. Let's just think about that. Public interest challenges only if they are direct benefit to the claimant. The whole point about a public interest challenge was that possibly it was in the public interest. So Maya Evans, the woman who was arrested in Parliament Square for reading out names of soldiers who had died in Afghanistan, brings this case about transferring the British soldiers, their Afghani detainees to face torture at the hands of the NDS. And she wins. She doesn't have a direct benefit, but you might think, and the court thought, it was in the public interest. The MOD, behind the scenes, lobby the Lord Chancellor. They're the only ones who do. It would be rather handy if you could please change the code. No more public interest judicial reviews that are not of direct benefit to the individual. We particularly would like that because we're fed up of these Iraq cases and we didn't like this Afghanistan case either. So could you please do that, Lord Chancellor? Yes, I have a broad discretion and it's a resources issue and I will amend the code. went off to the divisional court, who said, unlawful. Unlawful. Intriguingly, the case succeeded on the ground on which permission had been refused. If it had been the only ground in the case would never have been heard. The case went forward because of two other grounds that lost. Somebody, God bless them, somebody somewhere thought, even though permission's been refused on this first point, we will disclose the documents that are relevant to that point. And they did. And out it came. MOD, could you please make this change? Because it's rather inconvenient having to fight these cases that keep winning and showing that we're acting unlawfully. And on that basis, the divisional court says, well, we'll give you permission for judicial review on that point. And that point succeeded. A legally inadmissible consideration had been taken into account, and the true reasons had not properly been revealed in the consultation. As the court said, and it's worth just quoting it, particularly in the light of what you heard earlier on, for the state to inhibit litigation by the denial of legal aid because the court's judgment might be unwelcome or apparently damaging would be inimical to the rule of law. Wave the banner, but also let's not have sort of, let's have very. Natural justice is my penultimate topic, or for today, let's just call it the right to know. And it's very familiar, but you do wonder whether the lessons have been learned when you look through these cases. Look at the London Reading College on the 18th of October 2010, a case about licensing a registered English language college. Look at the safeguarding case, Royal College of Nursing, 10th of November of last year, declaration of incompatibility because the statute wasn't fair. Look at the Shoesmith case, 27th of May. That's a brilliant example of what Lord Justice Moses was talking about. That was the case where the court said unlawful, and the Court of Appeal said unlawful, and the government said, we'd do it again. We would do that again. Courts have just said that it was contrary to the rule of law, but we would just like the public to know that we would still do that again. Shoesmith, May 2011, and then Luton Borough Council, February 2011. That's the school building projects that were all going ahead because they'd had this business case approval, they were being relied on, and then the government says, no, we've decided in these straitened times that we're going to stop those. All of those cases succeed because in none of them was there the opportunity to respond to the basic criticism. It all just came out of the blue. The points aren't being put forward to be able to be responded to. And you know where this is coming from. This is coming from Strasbourg in a case called A, and they courts now say this. It's like practical and effective, which we borrow, because practical and effective is a really good phrase, and you don't need a convention point to say public law should be practical and effective. So irreducible minimum standard of fairness is a good phrase, and we don't need the ECHR to be able to rely on it. And that's what we get in those kind of cases. And damages. London Reading College, October 2010, procedural challenge succeeds. Just satisfaction, where's John Cooper smiling? Just satisfaction, courts are starting to do quite interesting things. I say John Cooper because he's got a case called Infinis, which is another quite interesting use of just satisfaction. So this was an unlawful decision. If it was unlawful in domestic law and it constituted an interference, it must lead to a breach of the convention rights. You wouldn't normally need that, but it's quite helpful when you come to remedies, because I'm going to give you damages. And that's what the college got, and that's what Infinis got. The two-card trick. I need to tell you about the two-card trick. Go back to A in the UK. Strasbourg says, core irreducible right to be told the substance of the case against you. And we think, wow, that sounds good. Why don't we do that? Wait a minute, I thought we did do that. Yes, we do that. We've remembered. You are entitled, even if you're facing a control order or an asset freezing measure or whatever it is, to know the substance of the case against you. You can't cloak everything with secrecy in the interests of national security or just decide it's inconvenient to let people know what you're really doing. Fine. A case called MAFTA, you might know it as Khaled, it was in April 2011 in the Court of Appeal, raises what seems to be quite a technical point of law on Article 6. It's asset freezing. The government, smiling sweetly, you may have been there, I'm not meaning to be offensive, but smiling sweetly, the government says, well, we would just like a ruling on a discrete point of law, if you don't mind. Don't worry about everything else. We just would like a ruling on whether this engages Article 6. This is a determination of civil rights or obligations, because we say either because it's action on the international plane, it's what we do with the UN, with the listing, which is sovereign, governmental, and falls outside Article 6, or because it's purely public matter, exclusively in the realm of public law. For either of those reasons, it doesn't matter which, this isn't Article 6, is it? And the court is scratching its head throughout the judgments in this case. We don't really see the point of this. Why does it matter? Fairness is a standard that applies across the board. We don't think it would make any difference if it were common law. Lady Justice Smith says in terms, it is very doubtful whether this could make any difference or have any impact on this case, she says. Why? Because you've got to know the essence of the case against you under common law natural justice, just as you would under Article 6. Well, okay, well, we'll decide the narrow point of law, and it's not a determination of civil rights or obligations, because it's exclusively the realm of public law. Oh, dear. That's card number one. Card number two, Butter, June of this year, Mr. Justice Mitting. The government says, well, that's very interesting. Now that we know that, we would like to make another point. The statutory scheme has a closed process. Magic tricks under Section 3 implying provisos for control orders, brilliant when you've got the Human Rights Act. But it's not going to work if you're applying the common law, because Parliament can exclude common law standards. Now that we've got a binding judgment in the Court of Appeal, card one, that this doesn't engage Article 6, thank you very much. You are not entitled to the substance of the case against you when you are seizing somebody's assets on the basis that they are a suspected terrorist. And Mitting says, well, that's right. And that case, thank goodness, is going to the Court of Appeal. The crack litigation team needs to sharpen its knives and get ready, I think, to go and join in. And that's where we are. What's the answer? Well, one good answer might be to say, don't be so ridiculous. Of course it's a determination of civil rights or obligations, and we don't care about rather unpersuasive French Strasbourg cases about immigration. Another answer is to say we don't need Article 6, because if it interferes with Article 1 of the First Protocol or Article 8, that's good enough. They have implied procedural standards too, and there's a really good recent Strasbourg case on Article 8 that says these rights, procedural rights, apply throughout. Or, and the one to watch for is the Charter. The EU Charter is not restricted to civil rights, determination of civil rights or obligations. It applies a fair hearing across the board. If you've got an EU case, and one of these has been referred to Luxembourg already under the Citizens Directive, there's another one coming, you can rely on the Charter, or try and rely on the Charter, and that will introduce the same standard. So, proportionality, and then I'm done. If you look at Gaunt, June 2011, MacDonald, July, Hewitson, July, Public and Commercial, August, and Sinclair Collis, which is the one perhaps most worth reading if you're going to, June. That's the cigarette vending machines. All heroic failures to invoke proportionality, where the courts are saying, well, yes, this is proportionate. And so all of them reminding us that there is this margin that can be invoked to justify measures. And you would read those cases and just wonder whether the tide has turned, whether it needs to turn back in relation to the application of proportionality. Let's see where we are in a year's time. So, the annual public law ball is tonight. It is sponsored by Herbert Smith. The whole public law world will be there, being public lawyers. They will be talking all night about developments in the law. Nightmare. Why would you want to go? In the real world, mercifully, the Public Law Project and Herbert Smith and you know that the time for talking about developments in the law is 9 to 5 daytime at a unique event set up by practitioners for practitioners engaging with the practical aspects of judicial review with up-to-date information on the latest JR case law and trends. That is for the daytime. Please, avoiding sort of, have a good day. Thank you very much.
Mike, thank you. That was a tour de force. Mike is happy to talk to you over coffee if you've got any questions.